Welcome back, everyone. This is Austin Roberts. Here on the Ecosiv podcast, we engage leading thinkers in conversations about the kinds of transformations required to create a more sustainable, peaceful, and just world. In this episode, Andrew Schwartz talks with Dr. Steve Waddell, who has worked as a consultant, community organizer, educator, researcher, and collaborative leader for over 35 years. Andrew talks with Steve about transforming complex systems for the long-term well-being of people and the planet, which is to say, an ecological civilization. And now, here's Andrew and Steve.
Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Ecosiv podcast. I am your host, Andrew Schwartz, co-founder and vice president of Ecosiv. And today, I have the privilege of talking with my friend, Dr. Steve Waddell. Over the last 35, 40 years, Steve's been working on transformations as a consultant, a community organizer, an educator, researcher, and collaborative leader, working with impressive world leaders and organizations. His work with organizations, networks, and systems really ranges from local all the way to global. He's the founder of a number of initiatives, the co-leader of the SDG Transformations Forum, which is a growing system of people, organizations, and locales, which are developing transformation systems as key infrastructures to accelerate deep change. He's also a co-founder of Catalyst 2030, where I believe he serves on the board. It's a global network of social entrepreneurs. He's the lead steward of Bounce Beyond, a global community of people on the urgent journey to next economies through transformative practice and collaborative action. Three of the key concepts. I'm going to wrap your entire life into a nutshell here, Steve. So I hope you don't feel, if you don't like it, you tell me, okay? But the three key concepts across Steve's work, they include societal learning and change, which is basically a deep change strategy to address chronic and complex issues. The second concept being Global Action Network, which is a specific new organizational form that was coined by Steve. So I hope to hear more about that. And also the third being Transformational Complex Change Systems, which describes emerging groupings of change initiatives whose effectiveness can be greatly enhanced by consciously acting as such a system. So today we'll be talking about these things and more, talking about transforming complex systems for the long-term well-being of people on the planet, or what we like to call here an ecological civilization. So light conversation, not complicated at all, no depth to it, very shallow discussion, right, Steve? Thank you for joining us.
Well, my challenge is often to be able to be meaningfully communicating.
That is a challenge I'm sure you'll have no problem meeting today. You know, as we get started, I think something that I just am curious about is why systems change? I mean, there's so many different things you could be doing and working on, and this is the thing that you decided to devote your life to. Why?
Well, it really arises out of work I was doing as a leader of the credit union movement in Canada in the 1980s. And I was on the board of directors of the world's largest community-based credit union, Vancity in Vancouver, Canada. And just for your listeners, you know, just to understand, there are very different ways of organizing finance systems. In Canada, about 23-24% of the assets on deposit are in credit cooperatives or credit unions. And in the United States, for example, it's 2-3%. And when it's organized with a large credit union presence, there's a whole different range of opportunities. So with this particular credit union, I was part of a group that organized to become the board of directors, feeling there was a huge potential for this organization to do something around community well-being that had not been done there to date. And I was in that capacity, I was also on the board of directors of something called BC Central credit union, which is like the central bank for credit unions, is maybe the best sort of close analogy. And as well, there's a national organization for credit unions and a global organization for credit unions. So when we were making these changes at the credit union, I became very aware that there are, it's not just up to the credit union to decide what it wants to do. There's all these different levels that it's embedded in, or different systems, as you can call it. There's provincial legislation. There's federal legislation, less influential, actually, in the Canadian setting than provincial. But there's also something called the Basel agreements, which are in which are formed by basically the world's big banking organizations. And they set standards for lending and other banking standards that the credit union is obliged to follow. So it's not good enough to just focus on what the credit union can do. You've got to understand that what the credit union can do, it's embedded in these other systems. And so I was very keen. I worked for 10 years. We had great outcomes shifting the credit union from being basically an excellent provider of services to members, financial services to members, to doing that and becoming a core community agent for community economic well-being. But we were limited in what we could do because of these other agencies. So it made me very aware of that we've got to somehow find ways to work on all of these levels at the same time.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think one of the things that it's like a common theme for me as well is recognizing that the limitations of individual action without addressing the context in which those actions are taking place, because there are restrictions and restraints, right? So like, you know, I could reduce my energy input at home. You know, I could turn off the faucet while I'm brushing my teeth, right? These are good steps that can be taken, and I'm not trying to belittle any of them. But if we're not addressing the sort of entire structure on how is that energy produced, what does the grid look like, what is the sort of backing behind it, it feels like you end up sort of addressing a bunch of like, I don't know, almost like fragmented pieces or symptoms of a much larger complex problem if you don't address the sort of deeper context, the deeper system, the deeper structure that is sort of in which all of these things are taking place and are embedded. But I find that also very overwhelming.
The complexity and the scale are very overwhelming for individuals. And it's one of the reasons that I focused on the work that I focused on is trying to understand how to create accountability, if you want to put it, or embed in these, in our multiple levels, the purpose of well-being and our, you know, it's you deal with it in terms of ecological civilization, a vision of the future, of our future that I certainly resonate with. So how do we actually get there? And that's without addressing these multiple levels, we aren't going to be able to do it. So that's why I've been asking these questions for 40 years.
So in asking those questions, one of the things you came up with was this concept of a global action network. Can you say a little bit about what that is? How is it sort of a unique organizational form? What's involved in this?
Well, in 1999, Kofi Annan, who was Secretary General then, was wanting to look at new forms of global organizing. And I was asked to make a modest contribution to that report because of work I'd been doing globally around multi-stakeholder governance forms. So business, government, civil society collaboration, or intersectoral collaboration, it was called in the 90s. This was actually a new organizing form. At one time, we thought that these types of different organizations should just remain in their very distinct sphere and that they could not actually get together to collaborate. So that's the perspective I was coming from global work I'd been doing on those emerging forms. And what I spent was a decade of my life investigating something that we discovered through this report on the future of global governance. And it's what I call, as you said, global action networks. So these are multi-stakeholder global change networks. And they are, examples of them are Forest Stewardship Council, the Global Water Partnership, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Marine Stewardship Council, the Global Reporting Initiative. This is stakeholders getting together to say, how can we collectively address some of these big challenges, which we really would like to change? So they really emerged with power in the early 90s. There were a couple of earlier examples like IUCN, which is focused upon nature and nature well-being, which is arose out of the post-Second World War. And the most long-term one is probably the Red Cross, found in the last century. But by and large, most of them were established after the fall of the Berlin Wall, because the fall of the Berlin Wall provided an opening for new types of collaborations. And so this was one of the forms that arose. So one of the things that they do very well is connect with the local to the global. So this multi-level, multi-layered concept, they are organized within a global framework, but in fact, they are very much connected to local action. So for example, one of the ones I really like is Transparency International. And the fellow who founded that was at one time a senior person at the World Bank. He became very frustrated with the World Bank's attitude in the late 1980s and early 90s towards the concept of the problem of corruption. The World Bank said, oh, it's just a cultural issue. Some cultures are corrupt. And he said, no, actually, no one wants to have to deal with corruption, and it's a problem. And we're losing lots of our resources are being misdirected through corruption. And these are public resources. We should do something about it. So he quit the World Bank and then started setting up something called Transparency International. And he went around the world and he talked with the people. He put together a group of his peers who were also concerned about this to form Transparency International. So these were sort of global figures, people very comfortable working in a global environment. And he went around the world to talk to his natural contacts from the World Bank, which was other governments. So there's a great story a friend in Ecuador told me of him coming to Ecuador and saying he had just been speaking with the government about corruption and trying to get their support for this new organization, Transparency International. And this colleague, Valeria Durrani, she said, well, you're talking to the people who are driving the corruption. She said, it's the wrong people you're talking to. We're the organization that's trying to, it's an NGO, she was working with an NGO, that it was trying to address corruption. And out of that, he shifted from understanding there are lots of people in the world that are already trying to address corruption. This could be in business, it can be in government, it can be in civil society. And that it was what the role Transparency International should have is not thinking that it's going to initiate things, but it's going to bring together the energy of those people who are trying to deal with corruption. And so I hope that gives you some sense of the way the global to the local connects. So there's things that have to be done at the global level to create, dealing with the global intergovernmental organizations, the things like the OECD to get them on board with the corruption fight, the World Bank and others. There's things that need to be done at the local level to make accountability in the local governments. But it has to work at both of these levels, at all of these levels, to be able to be really effective.
Hmm. I you've got me interested in a rabbit hole that I don't want to necessarily go down, but I do just want to say that you're making me think about the intersection of culture and systems or structures, mm-hmm. right? So it's like to say, oh, well, you know, corruption is it's not a cultural issue. Is it a structural one? Or wait, what's the interplay between those? Like, how do systems create cultures, and how are cultures creating systems? And anyways, we don't have to get into that, but it is something that I think is really important for all of us to continue to reflect on.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a big interplay here. One of the key activities in all of my work is simply making things discussable. So that, if you want to have culture that's got corruption embedded in it as a key driving force, well, at least let's have a discussion about it. And so you can be aware of what the options are in the conversations. Right. Because those who are in the status quo organizations, when they're benefiting from corruption, they don't want to have that conversation.
They benefit from not having that conversation. Exactly. Exactly. You know, so when you talk about multi-stakeholder governance forms, you talk about sort of collaborating across sectors, across regions, across, how do you do that successfully? How do you work? Here's the challenge that I often encounter and that I see. We have cultivated a sort of, well, we'll just say a culture of expertise. So you say, in order to speak to something authoritatively or intelligently, you must be an expert in it. And if it's outside your area of expertise, then shut your mouth and you can't say anything reasonable. Yet what I hear you saying is, we actually need to be working across our areas of expertise, across our disciplinary boundaries, to work collaboratively on complex problems that are not themselves neatly tied up into specific sectors. So how do you work across, outside of your area of expertise, how do you work collaboratively across these artificial, yet also sort of real boundaries of knowledge in a way that can produce meaningful transformation? Does that make sense, the difficulty? Yeah.
Absolutely. But I would just preface it by saying that expertise is itself a form of power that people use to intimidate others. And you can see this very much in the finance system. There's a whole industry around intimidating people to think that they can't manage their own money. And this is where the money managers make their money. The finance system isn't that complicated. You know, they will create new instruments and new buzzwords, et cetera. But, you know, I manage my own money. I always have calls from money managers saying they'd like to help me out. And I'm always saying, I think I'm doing fine. Thank you. But there's a whole expertise is often used as an intimidation vehicle. So the importance of the stance is that I happen to know something. And it's a stance of working with others. So many times experts put in their own minds that they're going to tell others what's the right thing to do. I remember I had an experience of that when I went to the Philippines in 1996 or 97. I was working on the issue of multi-stakeholder processes for developing housing. And there were some very interesting things that were being done with community leadership in that area. I was being funded in part by USAID, the American Developmental Agency. And they asked me after I'd visited this, spent a couple of days looking at what was happening, to come and share some of my wisdom with them. And they asked me what my opinions were. And I responded like an expert. I told them what I thought, and I always think of this instance with such I feel embarrassment. I can still feel the heat rising on my cheeks. I mean, who the hell am I to have spent 2 days in a country I'd never been to before to be able to tell somebody what I thought? It was just not.
Isn't that why you have a PhD? Yeah, it's your credentials for saying whatever you want with authority, in any context. That's what a PhD is supposed to be.
That's the way it's often used.
Yeah.
I guess that a little bit of knowledge to be a
That's thing. Interesting.
So it's a stance working across these areas of knowledge, I would say, rather than expertise, or across areas of life experience rather than expertise.
Nice.
Is always one of real being humble and realizing somebody knows a lot that you don't know. And so there's always a process of questions and holding yourself out as possibly being wrong in some situation, or having put together certain things I happen to have put together in a way that was incomplete or inaccurate. And so it's really engaging and ongoing with a humbleness and an openness of spirit.
I love that. Yeah, that's cool. You know, so a lot of your work, it seems like, has focused, around the year 2030, right? You've done a lot of work with the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals from the United Nations, this part of this Agenda 2030, and you're working on Catalyst 2030. It occurred to me, as I realized that it's already August of 2022, we're only 7.5 years away from 2030. How does that make you feel? No, I don't answer that. You can if you want. But what sort of transformation, right? What sort of transformation would you like to see in the next 7.5 years?
Well, now that's a great question. Just reflecting on 2030 and the SDGs, I did start something called the SDG Transformations Forum. And it's because the SDGs resulted from a process that was unique in world history. There were actually consultations around the world to be able to help identify these goals. And the goals were for the whole world. There was something that preceded them called the Millennia Development Goals from the year 2000. But those Millennia Development Goals were basically the product of, experts, technical experts, rather than broader range consultations. And they were only for the southern countries or the developing countries, or however you want to term it, low-income countries. So I honor that accomplishment that the world has created these SDGs. However, I've never been a fan of the idea that they are going to be successfully implemented with government leadership, which is sort of, they came from a consultative basis and then they ended up falling back into their traditional interorganizational or intergovernmental organization mode of assigning to individual countries the responsibility for achieving these SDGs. They went through a whole bureaucratic process, which is a process which has led to the situation we're actually in. So the hard thing is that we used an innovative process to define the goals, but we actually don't have for the knowledge that's necessary, the structures, the processes, the capacities on individual levels to actually achieve them. As well, the goals were achieved largely within what I would call a failed paradigm, a paradigm which is actually causing the problems. It was a growth, an economic growth paradigm, and economic growth is part of the goals of one of the SDGs. And so you have a lot of dilemmas or paradoxes within the SDGs. So I would just say that they're great. They deserve to be honored. But it's going to take a continual challenge about the whole implementation process and a revision of the SDGs themselves to really get the type of change that we need. And Catalyst 2030 actually is a global network of social entrepreneurs, and it formed in 2020, specifically in reaction to the crisis around the SDGs, that it appears there's no way we're going to achieve them. So is there some way that we could intervene through the agency of social entrepreneurs around the world coming together to be able to really goose the work that's being done around the SDGs.
Yeah, I'd love to hear any answers to that question that you have. Like, how is that intervention going? Are we going to make it after all, thanks to Catalyst 2030? But maybe for another conversation. You know, you said something really important that I want to pick up on, and that's this notion of the SDGs being built around a failed paradigm. And I think it's something that I like to talk about is paradigms, sort of these worldviews and lenses that sort of, it's very in line with the sort of systems and structures approach to things, right? So what would your alternative paradigm look like? And what difference would that make?
Well, we, with a colleague who's on the ECOSYV board, Sandra Wadek, we've actually looked into how people are defining an alternative paradigm. And we looked at all of the approaches. So I see myself as part of a movement. You can think of it that way, although a movement is a very loose term in my language. But there's people who are trying to redefine a new paradigm or to define a paradigm that will be able to bring about the social equity, the addressing the degradation of the environment. And the general concept is one of how do we develop a flourishing future for all life? And there's lots of paradoxes in that vision. But that's the direction that we see those focused upon economic change, such as the Well-Being Economy Alliance, the Common Good Economies, the Regeneration Economies, the Circular Economies, the Donut Economics. They're really all share this certain vision of the future that's based on a very different value system. But the end dynamic that people are aspiring for, the end outcome of the dynamic they're aspiring for, is that there is a flourishing of all life with a sense of equitability and honor.
It just occurred to me that neoliberalism might be a pizza economy where everybody's trying to get their piece of the pie. And that makes me sad because I like pizza so much. I don't want to affiliate it with a bad paradigm. But let's forget I said that, people. Pizza's still okay. Let's talk about economics a little bit. I know, like you were just saying, right, that so the growth paradigm is sort of is really, in a sense, this economic paradigm. So one of the things that you've been working on is bouncing beyond. I'd like you to talk a little bit about bouncing beyond from what, bouncing beyond to what, and how sort of the next, what is this idea of the next economies? What do they look like? How are they different from our current economy? And what, pick one of those 10 questions I just asked, anything that comes to your mind.
The term and the concept of bounce beyond arose at the beginning of 2020 with the advent of the COVID crisis. And people were talking about bouncing back, bouncing forward, bouncing better. And we said, you know, this is really not going to get us to where we've got to get to. They're still grounded in bouncing back to the old framework. And the old framework is what the problem is. And yet we have all of this energy, which is bouncing forward for this new vision, which is well beyond what the current one is. And so we developed the term bouncing beyond because we feel that that's what's required at this time of crisis. And indeed, we have the capacity. We know enough about transformation now and the processes of it to actually do it. But it's a future life which has this different set of values, which is the very basis for being able to create collective direction. And it's this is not an overnight process. It is, we emphasize, is one of what we call a design feature. We have to design into our world evolutionarity. So the past paradigm was really focused upon, you know, stability and permanence. So people wanted something very stable and they wanted to have permanent organizations. If you think about it, a permanent organization is usually one that's holding something in place. It's not one that is integrating life, because life is continual development. And it's not integrating new knowledge, because new knowledge suggests that we have new capacities, we can do new things, we can change with it. So how do we create this evolutionary dynamic that is integrated? It is, we have a need for a resilience dynamic, et cetera. So these are the sort of qualities that are part of the future, along with the more common ones that we refer to of equitability and fairness and justice and environmental flourishing. But the for me, this sense of crisis really arose in 2015, 2016, around, and I was quite despondent because I could see no way we were going to achieve, address adequately the climate change challenge. The continual meetings, we're now up to 27, of world governments has proven very not up to the task, is the way I would put it politely. And yet we continually having these meetings, hoping that they will somehow suddenly be up to the task. So it's like always pushing on the same door, hoping it will open when it's not opening in the past. But out of that crisis, I wrote a book called Change for the Audacious, Creating a Doer's Guide to Creating Our Future. And key for me was asking, well, if I feel this despondency about what the future potential is, what should I do about it? And I felt that I know something about networks. I know something about change processes. So I've developed this concept of finding, creating, encouraging the development of certain exemplary new futures in particular locations or around particular industries, and connecting them gradually over time so that collectively they would start to feel the power of each other to be able to emerge a collective future and collective action. So for me, that whole concept is still part of what's driving me, which is one reason I'm so delighted to connect with you at EcoSiv.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exciting. So when we talk about, big transformation, right? You're not just saying, okay, we're going to transform a sector like the economy, which is already like daunting, but you're like, okay, but we're going to do it by also transforming the paradigm on which that economy is established, which is the philosopher in me is wanting to be like, yay, let's talk about permanence versus impermanence. And, what that means for how we establish how we organize human life and human in social systems. But, obviously this kind of big, deep transformation, as our friend Jeremy Lent talks about deep transformation a lot, it's got to be fraught with a lot of challenges and obstacles, right? So what are some of those big barriers to that kind of transformation, let's say even just with economic systems? Mm-hmm.
Well, on the interpersonal level, one of the ones I alluded to at the very beginning is simply being able to interchange with people at a level that's meaningful for them. It's not about, my appropriate or somebody else's lack of something. It's my lack of being able to communicate effectively. We did talk about impermanence. It's a core Buddhist concept as well. And I am a practicing Buddhist. And I do think that, there's different ways of communicating to people, and to find the right way of communicating is one of honoring ourselves in where we are in our own developmental journeys and where others are in the developmental journeys. So part of it is finding the right language to talk to what other people are feeling in their lives as pain points and what they are trying to do and having trouble with. And that's a critical, skill, or it's a critical positioning to come to when you're in communication with somebody else. So for me, that's the basis of effectively working at a transformation, you know, doing transformation work.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes.
But I can talk about other barriers as people usually think about them. So as well.
No, you got me thinking about the creation of like a Buddhist paradigm for new next economies, which I think my my friend Zach Walsh would definitely be very interested if he's listening to this. But yes, these, of course, those are some of the big challenges, right? These interpersonal things, part of it is changing the way we think, right? And how do we change our thought processes, those patterns of thinking that have sort of even developed unawares, right? I mean, when you talked earlier about the distinction between is corruption cultural or is it, you know, systemic? Is it some blend between? And often it's just raising that question and being aware of it that's sort of the first step. So thinking about sort of steps for change or steps for transformation, do you have like a theory of change in mind when you said, okay, we want to sort of see the global transformation that is also sort of lived and expressed contextually in local context. What's your theory of change look like for how do we change the world?
Well,
in 30 seconds or less, of course. Yeah.
I always start with the basic assumption that there's lots of people who are working on it. And it's partly is a way of thinking about the relationships between lots of those people. And how do we create meaningful connection in the sense that we really increase our ability to work for that future? And so on one level, speak about the development of transformation systems as a key agent for this. So a transformation system, you know, we have healthcare systems to develop healthcare. We have food systems to produce food. Well, we need transformation systems for producing transformation. And in fact, they already exist. They're organized around particular issues, like there's a transformation system around climate change. It's all of those initiatives that are trying to work for a similar direction to end fossil fuel use or get to neutral carbon use. For me, one of the big insights was work I did in 2013, 2014, when I was working on this question from a global perspective. And we were saying, if you think of all of the, so one perspective is about the individual and how the individual has to change their values and ways of interacting to be able to produce this desired future. And a second level is to think about organizations and how organizations and production systems have to change in terms of the way they structure their production systems, the way they develop what their new products are like, et cetera. Another level is about the environment, what we call the enabling environment that allows or inhibits those who are trying to move to this new paradigm and to move to that new paradigm. So if you could think of it from that perspective, I was interested in how do we create an enabling environment to greatly accelerate the aspirations, the movement to the aspirations for a carbon neutral world. So this is always where the audacious part comes in, right? I said, well, we can look at, earlier I was leading something called the Global Finance Initiative and did work around this very question too. So I feel comfortable in these complex, audacious questions. So there's a process of mapping these types of systems It's called web crawl mapping. And basically, you can create a map that has the websites of each organization that is involved in developing, moving towards this new future. And so that's what we call the transformation system. So it's all of those entities that are trying to move towards a carbon neutral, in this case, future. And that's where this concept of a transformation system came from. And when I looked at what people were doing, I brought together actors, people from all of these different organizations, you know, somebody from an energy utility, somebody from the International Renewable Energy Agency, somebody from Net Global Network of Cities working on this issue, somebody from the Carbon Project. And we showed them, we had ways of showing them what they were doing in relation to each other. And for them, then they could understand something about it they'd never understood before. You know, I had the classic experience when I was gathering the data with the World Bank, and I went to the World Bank and said, well, this is what I'm doing. I've got this way of thinking about these five activities that have to be, that people are engaging in, and these different, there were 35 different activities. It sounds complicated, but it's not. You can put it on a wall, people can see it. And I said, so I'm trying to figure out which of these the World Bank is involved in. And their initial response was, we're doing them all. And I said, well, probably not. And if you are, you're probably going to want to rethink that, because you just don't have the legitimacy and the competency to do them all. And so then we mapped what they were doing, and there were like eight key things that they were doing. And we could map what the others were doing, and they could then see, for example, in this meeting, there were two initiatives that were trying to globally, that were trying to address the amount of consumption of energy of commercial and residential entities, organizations. And they didn't even know about each other. And once they found out about each other, they could actually integrate their process and work much more effectively. Now, that did not mean that they became one big organization, but it meant that they could create coherence about what they're doing. It's not about, people often think of scale as becoming one big organization. The transformation system strategy is not about becoming one big organization. It's becoming aware of the transformation system and the opportunities to really up your game once you understand what the opportunities are for connecting with each other and changing the dynamic of that whole system, the whole system that's creating energy sustainability.
I was just, envisioning like a, I don't know, I probably shouldn't even say this because it's probably a bad analogy that I haven't thought through all the way, but like something like
the analogy and the pie analogy.
I don't know. Well, okay. Pizza. Yeah. It's still good. I'm like imagining like for some weird reason, trying to hold up a wall and thinking you're doing it all by yourself and not really realizing that on the other side of the wall, there's somebody trying to do the same exact thing and you're sharing a wall and you're both trying to hold it up at the same time.
Beautiful.
And that awareness of the other could help you collaborate and coordinate your efforts to greater success. And I think there's something magical about what you're describing as recognizing one piece, it sounds like, is sort of, we need to just start thinking in terms of systems. And when we try to start to think as a systems thinker and start to recognize the complex web of interconnections and relations, then we can start doing this mapping process where we understand where we fit in this sort of web of relations, and how we can connect with others to sort of maximize our impact to achieve our sort of shared collective goals for a world that works for all, for an ecological civilization, a more sustainable, peaceful, just world. I mean, just call it what you want. I think that most people probably, well, what was it you said in the beginning? Nobody really wants corruption. Everybody's trying to get rid of it. It gets in the way. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. But definitely, majority of people I've ever talked to would prefer, they'd prefer well-being over not well-being. I mean, was it ill-being? I mean, right?
Well, it's just talking about about the system's thinking is certainly critical to all of this. You know, we're moving from a pointillist, you know, one point sort of minds, mental models to the system of connectedness models. And I'm always discovering how I'm carrying still that old mental model forward. So I hear a lot of people speak as systems thinkers, and they speak with such assuredness, they don't even recognize that they carry still the old model. And it's a question of really understanding how deep that model is. Like one of the common references I often hear people who say they're systems thinkers, they speak about the root cause. Now,
I've made that error myself many times.
A root cause really suggests there's a silver bullet that can solve this, right? And the systems thinkers say a really profound system thinking is about there is no silver bullet. That's why we're caught in this complex maze. There's a set of deeply interconnected activity. There's knots of activity that have to be untied. And but these things are very common. You know, we don't understand how deep the old thinking is. And so we're still developing these ideas.
I blame Aristotle, but we can get into that some other time. There's something so counterintuitive, really, to Aristotelian type logic that's, of course, you know, causation is linear. You have cause that, you know, leads to an effect, and it's a one-to-one A to B kind of scenario. So this whole idea that things are complex, that there could be non-linear causation, that sort of an effect is also, you know, a cause to the cause, it's also its effect. And there's sort of these looping causes and effects that are feedbacking on each other. It's like all of a sudden things seem very, very complicated.
Well, that's where we were at the very beginning with your question about systems and my suggestion with the finance area about how I learned about how they're all interacting.
Yeah. And interaction seems to be key, right? Trying to understand relations. And how can we, so when you talked about creating an environment, basically, where we can sort of maximize flourishing, that sounded to me like recognizing how, because I think here's one of the problems that I've been thinking about lately is how so many of our solutions are actually deepening the wounds that we're trying to overcome because they're feeding into a system that's reinforcing the problem rather than solving it. And that trying to find ways where we can step out of that sort of more narrow causal understanding to something bigger and more complex might allow us to sort of tweak or recreate new systems and structures that might actually enhance, might lead to the goals that we want rather than undermining ourselves with the very solutions that we're trying to come up with.
Right. It's very related to the question of capture or co-optation, that people come with this energy for change and transformation. And if the old system can, it will capture that innovation and integrate its traditional logic into it. We've seen that in the finance arena. We've seen it with a whole series of innovations that held great promise. The socially responsible investment movement, which was originally out to try to transform investment practice, it became a niche product of Wall Street. You know, it was just another way you can invest. It wasn't about the reform so much. Microcredit movement, which did so much wonderful work around the world with Mohamed Yunus and others, and it was putting people in power in relationship through lending circles. And what we've had happen there is that Wall Street has again intervened, and it's securitized lending to market to these lending circles so that they can make money out of it at these exorbitant rates. We've had impact investing, and there was a real desire for impact investing to be really support some of the transformational goals. Well, We've had this whole influx of people who are really about wanting to solve their conscience and say they're doing, point to something they're doing in terms of social and environmental impact, but they really are about maintaining some financial security and income. And then there's, so for me, it's critical to put a stake in the ground about what you mean by transformation and to be very diligent about understanding whether an opportunity is going to help you or co-opt you towards receiving your transformational goals. And there's lots of dilemmas. There's lots of lack of clarity when you're facing those actual questions. But it's the stake in the ground is very important. And I've seen so many initiatives that have lost their transformational capacity because they've wanted to get large. I mean, that's one of the things that happened with the microcredit movement. You know, so Wall Street offered them this big inflow of money so they could really grow. And, you know, that's where this patience of continually working at something over long periods of time, it's hard to do with persistence, but it's a critical quality.
There's so much that could be explored regarding, effectiveness with respect to size, with respect to power and decision making, democracy, all these sorts of things, right? And the sort of local, the extent to which it's in tension with global, and the extent to which it, is supported by, anyways. But I think we're running lower on time, so instead of getting into a whole new rabbit trail, I want to circle back around to sort of a theme that it keeps coming up, and that's complexity. And the fact is that a lot of this is, I mean, what we're facing right now, we're basically looking at multiple social environmental crises that are sort of complex and interconnected. What was it? Pope Francis basically said was, you know, it's not in Laudato Si. We're not facing two sets of crises, you know, one social, one environmental, but one sort of complex crisis that's both social and environmental. I'm like, oh, I resonate with that. That sounds great. Thank you, Papa Francesco. So that can be scary, and it can be, it can be depressive. You know, like, it's like, okay, well, the world's screwed. Guess we're going to, smoke it while you got it kind of thing. But like, I don't hear that from you. I don't hear a sense of defeat from you. I don't hear a sense of, well, I put in a lot of work over many decades, just time to, call it quits. What I hear is an energy and an excitement about, what I hear is hope, basically. And I'm curious if you can say, one, is that a fair assessment that you have some sense of realistic hope? And if so, why? What gives you hope?
Well, it's important to have joyousness in one's life and one's work. And that does not mean you do not recognize there's lots of struggles, there's lots of burdens, there's lots of barriers to what you're trying to do. But to take joy in working with those barriers and addressing them. So it's a learning process for myself as well about learning how to address them or how to work with them. And the complexity is certainly one of those issues. One of the things is we work with the concept of action pathways and adaptive pathways, which means you don't do planning and long-term planning, but rather you set your direction and you recognize, as a system science would tell you, that there's feedback loops that you will have difficulty perceiving in advance, and that you are continually open to adjusting your pathway forward. So it's an adaptive pathway, the actions you're planning on, you foresee taking, but you aren't adjusting the direction that you're moving in. So that's for me, the basic way I deal with complexity. I feel that there's a lot of change energy in the world. And so that's what my basic sense of hope is about. I know in the last 6 months or so, I've been really looking at the world of DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations. and the quality and the profundity of the conversations of people in that who are developing DAOs, and the high level aspirations that so many of them have, asking questions about power and how can we restructure our society. And this is a technology that really allows us to think about that in a very profound way. That's an example of a source where I find a lot of inspiration. So it's being aware that there is a lot being done. I look at the current papers, the traditional, the legacy newspapers like the New York Times, very little. I do read them go through it very quickly every morning just to know what that world is seeing. But I spend my time with those who are working for this joyous and aspirational future. And so that's a choice that we can make about where we're working and how we're spending our focus. So don't spend it with the legacy newspapers. Try things like a colleague, Indra Adnan's work with The Alternative, which is pointing all of these joyous and very interesting and inspiring alternatives that are emerging all around us.
That's great advice. I'm imagining people listening right now saying, I love this Steve guy. He's so great. He's got so many cool ideas. I would love to support, be a part of a transformation system. I'd love to become a transformation catalyst. What can they do? Where should they begin? What advice do you have for them concretely?
Well, they can contact me if they're interested. My email is S as in Steve Waddell, WADDELL, at bouncebeyond.global. And I'm happy to share some of our learnings. You can go to the Bounce Beyond website. There's some information there. If you're working from an academic point of view, there's a large number of articles that myself and my colleague, Sandra Waddick, have co-authored. And we're going to be having a new book coming out in the fall on catalyzing transformation. And it's written more for the advanced practitioner level about developing transformation systems.
Fantastic. We'll definitely have to have you and Sandra come back and tell us about this book when it's out. That sounds wonderful. Steve, as always, it's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for taking the time and communicating so clearly, which was your goal. You succeeded. It was a pleasure. And for everybody who wants to learn more, of course, Steve just gave some great places to check out some more information. We'll also include some info about some of his audacious books in the description of this episode, so you can learn more, some links to websites and all those good things. Steve, any last bit of wisdom you want to leave us with?
No. Feel honored in the work and share appreciation generously.
Absolutely. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.